This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Robert Stark here. I'm joined here with James O'Mara. We're going to be discussing his book, Mysticism After Modernism, Crowley, Evola, Neville, Watts, Colin Wilson, and Other Populist Gurus by Manticore. It's published by Manticore Press. James O'Mara, great speaking with you. It's been quite some time.
Yeah, great to hear from you, Robert. Great to talk to you again. Great to be here.
So I guess to give some background information about the book, you have an interest in mysticism and where mysticism and the occult intersects with your other guy, cultural and political interests. Were you personally interested in mysticism and the occult as far as it being effective, or is it more just an academic look at mysticism and its influence on culture?
Well, I'm certainly only interested in it so far as, well, I'm interested in both things, but I would probably be less interested if I didn't think it had some efficacy. So I'm interested in people who are interested in being effective. Particularly in the modern age, and the idea of mysticism after modernism, essentially being that all the essays book are sort of united by the theme of that these are people who have sort of broken with tradition or orthodoxy and so on, and are have a more, I don't want to say necessarily scientific interest. They're not scientists necessarily, but they have a more practical interest in magic and mysticism, magic really, in practical terms. You know, does it in fact work? I might not be in that case if I didn't think that magic and mysticism had but I did come at it from a sort of back in the day it was called the alt-right kind of perspective, because I guess I really got interested in it in that angle of it with Evola. When I was a teenager, I was listening to Alan Watts, and that was the origin of my interest in these kinds of areas. Watts got me interested in a contemporary guru who at that time was named Dafri John. He went through a number of name changes, ultimately becoming Adi Da, and died a few years ago out in California. I was also eventually became interested in traditionalism. And on traditionalism, I eventually discovered Evola and was particularly interested in him because he seemed to have a sort of practical attitude. He was not sort of like saying, you know, there are all these wonderful traditions which we've lost contact with and we'll never get back to because it's the Kali Yuga and we can just have to wait for everything to collapse, and then maybe someday something will happen. And by the way, there's no such thing as reincarnation, says Ganon, so you're just going to be dead anyway. that wasn't a very inspiring viewpoint, but Evola was interested in making changes in the real world, which is one reason why he was interested in people like Crowley.
The thinkers in the book listed are William Burroughs, Aleister Crowley, Colin Wilson, Alan Watts, Neville Goddard, and Julius Evola. And I'm sure there's a whole bunch of other ones who also are relevant to this. But those are the main ones. And I think, well, yeah, but there is this kind of, actually, I think there was like a stereotype of like the new age movement, and both like the hippie counterculture, kind of like being more of the left. And that's even like there were points like even associations like with Crowley and how people on the right, like the way it's treated, like it's either the part of the hippie counterculture or liberal new age types, or the view is more that like the more kind of Alex Jonesy side of the right associates it with kind of like the evil of like our current of like the current kind of liberal elites. Like that's how a lot of right wing populists are dismissive of it. And like there's actually like that's not necessarily true. It's very like there's a lot of nuance and interesting angles. And then even further back, like I think I was listening to a show on Jeffrey Mishlove about some of the transcendentalists of the 19th century and how they actually did have some influence on like things like women's suffrage and the abolitionist movements, which you would associate more with the left. But that your focus is more on like the 20th century. But like there are thinkers like Crowley are much more interesting and complex. And then even a lot of the beatniks writers, I think like Burroughs is probably the one would have things about them that are not conventionally you'd think of as like liberal. But there is so much like crossover appeal and nuance. So you can take someone like Jeffrey Mishlove's show. He's probably more like of the 60s counterculture, probably like more of the left of a universalist. But then he's had on like people like Jason Reza Georgiani, and there was a lot of like crossover. And then you look at like Evola, out of the thinkers, Evola is probably the most traditionalist and of the right of these thinkers. But like a lot of them, maybe not so much. But like overall, how much would you say that like mysticism is fundamentally like at odds with modernity and liberalism, like despite a lot of the 60s counterculture and the New Age movement that came after that?
Well, the thing that, as I was saying before, one thing that links the various people I talk about in the book is their interest in practical mysticism. An aspect of that that maybe illuminates this crossover, as you were talking about, is that the left, I guess, likes to talk about changing the world, progress, and things like that, but tends to be tied to a materialist viewpoint. And on the other hand, people who have a more spiritual viewpoint, as you say, tend to be fall into the sort of hippy-dippy, new agey sort of area. And the people I look at in this book sort of fall between those stools, because they're very interested in magic as Crowley defined it, as changing the world in accordance with will, which of course sounds like it would be very much like progressive liberalism and Tikkun Olam among the Kabbalists and so on. But the modern left is a very materialistic, anti-religious, anti-spiritual sort of entity. And these people are very much spiritualists. One person I don't talk about in the book, although I talk about Neville Goddard, who's I think the greatest figure of New Thought. But one of the early New Thought writers of the turn of the century, William Wallace, actually ran for president a couple of times on the Socialist Party ticket. His socialism was based on New Thought that, he thought that the capitalists and the social Darwinists that were popular at the time, were working from the assumption that, that everything was fixed. There's only a small amount of stuff and people had to compete for it. And, from his New Thought or idealist point of view, this was nonsense. You just had to, use the power of the imagination to create what you want. So
So in a sense, like almost like alchemy.
almost like alchemy. Yeah. So precisely because he wasn't a materialist and was an idealist and thought you could use the mind to bring things into existence, as Crowley did as well, that made him a socialist or at least a non-capitalist. Evola, people on the left don't want to talk about Evola because they think he's a Nazi and so on, and traditionalists don't want to talk about Evola because precisely because he wants to do things in the world. You know, the traditionalists love people like Gainon, who say, you know, you can't do anything. There's these cosmic cycles. We're in the Kali Yuga. You just have to sit back and wait. Heidegger, by the way, is exactly the same.
Like there's a legitimate argument that we have gone through these like historical cycles, but then the critique of liberalism as just being this upward progression towards progress. But I find that like very demoralizing about the right, that they say like we just have to kind of accept decay and go for these cycles and not like dream big. I really actually really detest that.
Well, you see, it once you start looking for that, you can see it all over the place. For instance, the QAnon business.
Well, they're almost kind of, QAnon's almost like kind of, I think, been described as like Gnostic in a sense.
Well, but the mentality is don't do anything. Stay with the plan.
Right.
Believe the plan. Everything's planned out. It's already happened behind the scenes. Just wait for Trump to strike. It's all an illusion. He's only pretending to go to jail. That's all part of the plan. You see. You know, the message is always don't do anything. And that's kind of a Gnostic thing, but it's also kind of Gnostic to believe that you can actually change things, that you have access to higher dimensions, and can use those to work change in the real world. And that's the thing that's interesting about the people that I study in the book.
A good one to start with is like I have them kind of listed out in order. Like we'll start with Alan Watts. And yeah, like I've actually have been listening to a lot of Alan Watts' speeches on YouTube, these seminars he gave. And as interesting as it is, again, it kind of goes to that theme, it's open to interpretation. So many times he does seem like more kind of a liberal universalist or hippie at time, because it's very much influenced by Buddhism, like the stereotype of Buddhism. And again, like there's a lot of complexity there. Like there's right wing or people on the right who kind of critique Buddhism as being maybe demoralizing as far as like letting go of all attachments and connections. But there's a lot more nuance than that simplistic view. But at Watts does seem like, I get the impression, he talks about letting go of attachments, and he's been kind of critical. He's sort of like critical of tribalism. You do get the impression that mm-hmm. he does believe in all humanity being kind of interconnected. But then there are different angles to him, because I was listening to Brian Scott's YouTube channel. It's called You Are It. It's an Alan Watts speech, like this kind of spiritual elitism, where Watts talks about like, he talks about like the masses who are conformist and lack like spiritual curiosity or creativity. Like they're kind of like, views them as like lesser, as a sort of like spirit, almost like a spiritual kind of Nietzschean. And then also he gives an example where he's talking to a young woman and he says like he doesn't care about her credentials, because like her beauty is like, that's something that's like genetic or inborn. And like I was listening to that sounded like something almost like stereotypically you'd hear more on the right today. And right. Some things that he says, like there's this figure on the online right, like BAP or Bronze Age Pervert, a lot of similarities where Watts talks a lot about like tapping into that like vitality. Yeah. So he was heavily influenced. Watts was heavily influenced by Buddhism, but was he also influenced by, I think he may have been influenced by Jung, possibly even Evola. But what do you think about like specifically about Alan Watts that goes beyond that stereotype of him just being kind of a hippie? Cause there's so many different like unique angles to him.
Oh yeah, that's a good way to put it. There are many, many angles to him. Before I forget about it, you mentioned Nietzsche, and that which is interesting because Watts never attended university in England. He was because he was trying to get a scholarship to Cambridge, and he failed the test. He says in his autobiography, because he wrote in his essay on courage and the spirit of Nietzsche, whom he had just read. So actually it was the influence of Nietzsche that kept him out of the university. So there's that, but there are many things that angles, as you say, that make Watts more of a man of the right than you would think. You would ordinarily think, especially in his later years, you think of him as the hippie philosopher. One of the essays in my book is an analysis of his book, Behold the Spirit, which he wrote in the 40s when he was an Episcopal priest. And it's a Spenglerian book. In fact, he assumes Spengler's morphology of the way civilizations develop, and he applies it to religion. He differs from Spengler because he's an optimist. He thinks that what Spengler calls the second religiosity is actually a rebirth of religion. So Spengler would probably be not amused, but nevertheless, it's a Spenglerian book. Also, Watts's social philosophy, his economics and so on, is basically a social credit.
Oh, right. So there is, I actually found this article on this on Countercurrents, but like one big theme of Alan Watts is escaping, a lot of it is like kind of escaping the bullshit of society, like including like bullshit jobs theory, which is popular
right.
today, just like managerialism, like arbitrary rules and like bullshit kind of like life scripts that are keeping people kind of enslaved. That's a huge theme. And then I am looking at some other things. So on Countercurrents, I think it was Greg Johnson has an article on the spiritual materialism of Alan Watts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about Alan Watts's book, Does It Matter About Spiritual Existence? And he kind of had an interesting view on aesthetics. And at one point he made it interesting as he contrasted like the French, who were like, he viewed it as pure materialists. Well, Americans, like the American view towards aesthetics comes from this like weird, like Gnostic dualism between like the spiritual
mm-hmm.
and the material. And that kind of explains the American obsession, the Americans valuing quantity over quality.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this kind of assumption that Watts is not overtly political, but I think what you were going to reference was he has this essay, Wealth Versus Money, and he does advocate something like social credit. And social credit's not, I think it's not obviously not like the Chinese social credit system, which is totally
different.
But
yeah.
It's more like a version of basic income that I think is actually probably superior to like what Andrew Yang is advocating from
yeah,
C.H.
Yeah.
Douglas. And he calls for restructuring society and replacing work and basic society, but with more of a value on both leisure and on aesthetics.
Yeah, I don't know enough about it to make any intelligent comments, but given the nature of our audience or where we want to present Watts, it might be, I might suggest that it's kind of like National Socialist economics, and let that be the shorthand for it, so to give you some idea of what's going on. In other words, instead of from Watts's, the way Watts presents it, he presents it in this Buddhist New Age sort of way, saying money is just an illusion and et cetera, et cetera. Well, that's, Hitler would have agreed, National Socialist economics from what was his name? Gottfried Feder. Rather than having the central bank print money and then loan it to the government at interest, the government prints its own money, backed by the productivity of the workers. But without getting into the weeds of all that, Greg Johnson's article talks about this, and there's a Bosnian, I think, or Serbian sort of guru character that Watts was hanging around with in London. I can't think of his name is, Mitrovic or something like that. You can find it in Greg Johnson's article. So he was kind of a quasi-fascist figure, and consequently Watts never actually directly refers to him in his essay. That was an essay for Playboy magazine, by the way, on wealth. So he doesn't actually, make his connections obvious, but if you read his autobiography, he mentions this figure. It's just to add a couple other things here. He's if you think of him as a prophet of free love and all that, if you look at his actual life, he engaged in serial monogamy. In fact, he was really only married twice. There was a second marriage that was just to get someone out of Europe during World War II. Which oddly enough, Burroughs did the same thing. But Watts was married, and then he fell in love with somebody else, and so he you know, did the good thing and divorced his first wife, married the second woman, stayed married to her. Eventually, he wound up with about 17 children and grandchildren, and he worked to support them. So he's a very positive figure. If you want to talk about role models, he's a very positive figure for the right. He did more for the white race than most people on the right. You know, 17 children and grandchildren, worked to support them all. Not really a hippie, you know. That's ultimately what killed him. It was overwork, that killed him to do all these lectures and all across the country and so on.
I think he was very active, in California. I think he lived in Marin County.
Yeah. Speaking of Marin County, I mean, it's not, he's actually very much against, you talk about the way he talks about Buddhism and you know, scripts and liberating yourself from that and so on. He's not like a new age kind of guy, what I call a hot tub psychologist. In fact, in his autobiography, he's very direct about that. He mocks people, these guys. I think of them, he doesn't say this, but I think of them as like a fat, hairy, bald guy in a hot tub, saying, "Hey, come on, Alan, show us your real self. Let down all your guard." You know, the standard New Age crap. And Watts says, "When people say that to me, I say, I am me. I'm showing you what I am. You know, you're just not listening." So he doesn't buy that, all that hot tub crap. So there's this kind of a anti-psychology mentality there. And I might also mention one other thing. You know, you think about the hippies and globalism and one world and love your enemy and all that. In Behold the Spirit, when he was an Episcopal priest, he says that love your enemy means love him as your enemy.
Yeah, I think I have actually heard that. Maybe I read it from you or heard that somewhere. That's really interesting. Beyond kind of like beyond the mysticism and just traditional Christianity, so much of it, Bible is misinterpreted or it is open to interpretation over the years. And
yeah,
I mean, that's incredibly fascinating. And I think like another thinker who's misunderstood is, I'm not sure how much you get into Aldous Huxley. And I've read Brave New World, but it hasn't really been since high school. It's been a long time, but he's also misunderstood. Like, there's one view that he's like the whistleblower on the globalist elites. One view that he's like part of the New World Order Illuminati or this like Fabian socialist villain. But then there's another view that actually he had some really interesting ideas that are totally different than what most people assume with him. And interesting is another thing is like Watts was actually friends with Aldous Huxley.
Oh yeah. Yeah. But you know, you mentioned Huxley. I mean, I don't know very much about Huxley. I mean, I've read more than Brave New World, but not everything. I wrote a lot. It's interesting because, Neville, my personal hero in all this actually talks about meeting Huxley, not to get ahead of ourselves if we're going to eventually talk about Neville, but you should know that Neville was an immigrant from Barbados, from a British family there.
You know, it's kind of interesting. Is I was like researching my own like genealogy, and I may possibly have like a distant ancestor who was from Barbados but immigrated to Maryland, like around Maryland in like 1720.
Interesting. So he spoke, and this is part of his charisma as a lecturer. Neville was sort of a kind of overlapped, with, Alan Watts. And, he was also on the lecture trail. And, his attractiveness, his part of his charisma on the lecture trail was that, he had this lilting island accent.
There actually are some audio recordings of him speaking on YouTube.
There are hundreds of audio recordings of Neville, because Mitch Horowitz compares him to the Grateful Dead.
He's a New Thought scholar who wrote the foreword to your book.
He didn't write the foreword to my book, but he wrote a very kind blurb for Amazon use. There's actually a couple of reviews of his book, of books of his in Mysticism After Modernism. He compares him to the Grateful Dead because Nivelle didn't believe in copywriting his wisdom, so he would let people tape his lectures. This was in the 40s and 50s and so on. So people would bring these giant reel-to-reel recorders and put them on stage and record his lectures. So therefore, all this stuff is now available on the internet. There's hundreds and hundreds. There's like a book I have of 300 transcripts of his lectures. It's sort of like, also kind of like the Mystery Science Theater, where they had that thing at the end of the episodes, keep circulating the tapes. We can get into that later, but just to tie this up to Aldous Huxley, he says he met Huxley once, and he tried to talk about Blake. Now, Blake is a big hero to Nivelle, and much of his work seems to stem from Blake. It's a very interesting interpretation of Blake's poetry and the role of the imagination and so on. And he tried to talk to Huxley, and Huxley blew him off. You know, and Nivelle says he didn't like my accent. He's one of these English people who think that if you have an island accent, you're a moron. You know, words to that effect. Unfortunate! I could have enlightened him about the Blake, but he wouldn't listen. And this gets back to what you were talking about before about spiritual elitism. And all that. And Nivelle says very, very plainly, he doesn't believe in any elitism but the spiritual.
I mean, this is like a whole other tangent, but there's economic elitism, cultural elitism, and kind of like, again, spiritual elitism. And that's, I think Watts actually rejected the social and economic elitist, but I do think he was a spiritual elitist for sure. And yeah, you could just say there's different angles on that. It could just be about like, just rejecting conformity, even though that's a bit too simplistic. But like Goddard is interesting. Nivelle Goddard, so his belief, he was like an extensive biblical scholar, and he can like read, he basically memorized the entire Bible, which is remarkable. But his views were so different from traditional Christianity. He believed that your imagination was God, so some Christians would view that as a blasphemy. But I think Nivelle actually would find biblical verses that vindicated his position, or I think maybe something about our consciousness as God, something like that. So this idea that you can shape reality and future via thoughts. And yeah, there's so much that's interesting about this, because talking about that socialist, I do think like a lot of, there is also kind of an angle of like more libertarianism in like these like self-help gurus and pro-capitalism. Like you have the prosperity gospel, like the preacher who's a Christian preacher who influenced Donald Trump, who I found about via Gary Lachman's book on the occult. There was a Christian preacher who influenced Donald Trump, who was also influenced by Nivelle Goddard. But I think even some influence on like Oprah Winfrey and these like self-help gurus from the 90s. The big one, obviously, I forgot, I can't think of his name off the top of my head, but all these big like self-help gurus, like Nivelle was like, even though like he's not that well known, so many famous people were probably influenced by him.
Oh, yeah.
The thing is, it's interesting, but overall, what I think is remarkable about Nivelle Goddard is that his ideas, like you talk about kind of like practical mysticism, they don't at all seem practical. I think they seem the idea that you can meditate and imagine like $1 million just showing up in your doorstep. That sounds like totally grandiose, like the opposite of like the practical mysticism.
Well, he's practical in the sense that he's giving you a method. He's boiling it all down into a method. It's very American, as I say. It's very pragmatic, practical.
Oh yeah, Tony Robbins, like culture. Yeah. It's very much individualistic, very American, very capitalistic. That kind of like self-help, new age guru, like that. I'm sure, like someone like Tony Robbins, you can tell is like Very influenced by Neville Goddard.
Oh, yeah. God, I can't think of his name. Not Father Divine, but there was a black guy in Harlem who was very famous, who was explicitly influenced by Neville Goddard. He would quote Neville. God, I can't think of his name. But it'll come to me. But there was that guy. A guy, Wayne Dyer, admits being influenced by Neville Goddard. And just recommissioning stuff. But the point is, and Mitch Horowitz has done some good work on this, that Neville has basically a three-step method. And getting back to the Grateful Dead thing and so on, Mitch Horowitz says, with Neville, there's no cult to join, there's no membership fee, there's no books to buy. You can get all this stuff free on the internet. There's no cost at all. And Neville just says, try this method, go home and try it. If it doesn't work, you haven't spent anything. I haven't taken any money from it. If it does work, great, write me a letter and tell me about it. And I'll use it in my lectures. It's three steps. And Mitch Horowitz has explored these in several of his recent books and linked them to, actual laboratory studies about these matters. For instance, the first step is to induce a state of inactivity or relaxation.
Yeah, so a good
And this,
example is
and
like this YouTuber Brian Scott, who's like a devotee of Neville Goddard. He primarily does like meditation is like the main technique. So
yeah.
basically, like an emphasis, get into that like hypnagogic stage before
Exactly.
you go to sleep, and then think, and then like dream big, focus on what you most desire. Like that's basically the essence of it.
Yeah, well, as he mentioned the hypnagogic state, so I mean, we can link this to actual laboratory studies about the hypnagogic state and various brainwave states and so on, which Neville doesn't talk about. He just talks about, I mean, he used to enjoy having a big lunch and going with several martinis and going home and taking a nap on the sofa. But usually it's either early in the morning before, when you're waking up, or at night when you're going to sleep, those liminal states, the hypnagogic states, are the place where this happens. Previous to that, actually, the first step, really, if you want to be precise about it, the first step is to determine what you actually want, and that's where the whole $1 million thing comes in.
Do you
People.
have to really like feel the passion for it? It can't just be like a simple thought.
Exactly. You can't just, it's not a magic trick. It's not a stupid human trick. You can't just say, okay, manifest a glass of beer on this table right now. Yeah. No, it has to be your deepest desire, because as Crowley said, it has to be, you have to identify your will with God's will. So this is serious stuff, and you have to really be honest with yourself and think a lot about what you really want, because the next step is to create an imaginary scene that would imply the fulfillment of your wish. And the third step is to imbue it with passion, as Avila says, to love it with a warm fire, which he gets from The Alchemist. As Neville say, feeling is the secret. That's the title of one of his books.
Yeah, and this is
And
like
that's the secret, because that's why you can't just do this in a
it's a
laboratory, or you can't
feeling and
just
a seeing it.
arbitrarily. Yeah, you have to imagine that scene until it takes on the atmosphere of reality, and then dismiss it. Austin Spare and Crowley and so on would say the same thing, or Genesis Peorage in our own time. Would say the same thing. Once you imbue it with that reality, then you dismiss it from your mind. You never think about it again.
This is also kind of like very Crowleyan. But this
Oh yeah,
also
it's
makes me
entirely
think
Crowley.
of like meme magic and the idea that like Trump got elected because of affirmations and like Pepe the Frog memes, like stuff like that.
Well, I among the essays in my book are ones that talk about the relation of Crowley to all this. It's fairly obvious. Magic being control of reality by the will. Aleister Crowley's personal secretary at one point was a guy named, his name, Israel Regardie. Leaving Crowley's employ during the Second World War, he was in America and he met Neville Goddard and wrote a large chapter in his book, The Romance of Metaphysics, about Neville Goddard. The first mention of him in literature. It's very interesting to read.
I think Crowley himself, I think he actually died before Neville became really active.
Certainly before Neville became really known. He was giving lectures during World War II. He used his method to get out of the army.
Oh, right. I heard about
Interesting
that. Yeah,
story.
that's interesting.
But in any event, you can read about that in my book or in Mitch Horwitz's books. Mitch Horwitz, you know, this is what he's done. He's gone into the army records and so on and verified the dates and things and so on. There's even an article in the New Yorker talking about Nibble's lectures later that year. So we have the whole timeline, and it corresponds to what Nibble said. The point is, Israel Regardi says that of all the New Thought practitioners and theorists and so on, Nibble's is the most magical. So here we have someone who is intimately familiar with Crowley's work, also familiar with Neville's work, and makes that connection that Neville is practicing magic in the Crowleyan sense. He also says, to get back to something you said before, Neville's listeners would be very disappointed to learn that he's really an atheist.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Because he thinks that God is your human imagination. God isn't some guy in the sky.
Well, that means he rejects God in the traditional Abrahamic sense,
right.
But if he believes your imagination is God, that is some kind of a metaphysical belief that I wouldn't call that atheism.
Well, yeah, he's being a little provocative there, but see, that's what I was saying before. He's not, you know, your sort of left wing materialist progress believer, anti-religion kind of guy, because he believes in your imagination being all powerful. Your imagination is ultimately the same thing.
And obviously not everyone's imagination is equal.
Because it requires training, and that's where elitism comes in. And that's why it's so important that these people I'm writing about, talk about what you need to do. You know, Crowley wrote many books trying to explain in modern terms, in scientific terms, how magic works and how you do it. Neville did the same thing, not scientifically, but as an interpretation of the Bible. Alan Watts, Colin Wilson, all the people I talk about in there are trying to find ways to make magic something that people can actually practice and thereby prove it to themselves, as Neville says. I mean, the only proof modern people, and this is what Alan Watts is talking about in his Spenglerian point of view, the modern world, we're not interested in traditionalism. We're not interested in faith. We're not interested in that. We're interested in proving it to ourselves by experience. And so these
proving,
are,
like proving the existence of God via science. It was a huge, what happened was it was a huge thing, like spiritual science or alchemy, proving the existence of God via science. It was huge for a while during the Renaissance. But then I think what happened is during the Enlightenment, both like the Christian side and the secular humanist side were adamantly opposed to that concept, which is a big shame. I think it's very important, actually.
Well, that's what, and Neville makes that point that go home, use my method, and thereby, you know, when it works, because he's sure it'll work, when it works, you will have the best possible proof of the existence of the spiritual world. You will have proven it. Let me just make this one point that, you know, you're talking about Oprah and all these prosperity people and so on. That's only one aspect of Neville's work, because that's what he called the law. And of course, today we have the what's called the law of assumption, and the law of attraction, rather.
The law of attraction is... That was an. I think that's another famous book, but I think much more famous than Neville. But it's I'm sure probably influenced by him.
Oh yeah, yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. So they get that from Neville.
One is I forget the name, but there's
the
another
secret.
Book that's more obscure called like Telecosmic Power. That's another one.
Oh, well, that's obscure enough. I haven't heard of it.
Like Anthony Something like Italian sounding name, like Anthony.
Damasio?
Maybe. I don't know the. Well, it's
Is it
called like
Anthony
Telecosmic Power.
Damasio? Well, I'll look that up. But anyway, he called it the law. Now, in the late 50s, Neville had a mystical experience in which he was reborn from outside of his skull, which he related to Golgotha, the place of the skull. He had this intense mystical experience, and he began talking about it. This was the experience of becoming one with God. And he called this the promise. So there was the law and there was the promise. And the purpose of the law was to make your life easier and to prove to you in experiential terms that the spiritual world existed, that God existed. And on that basis, you could anticipate the process, the promise. The promise is what he was really interested in. He said that the idea was that people would acquire all the material goods they wanted and thereby learn that that wasn't what they wanted. But you could only do that if you got the stuff. Otherwise, you would just be hankering for it. Oscar Wilde said something similar. People didn't like this message, even in the 50s. They wanted the old, what we would today call prosperity gospel. They wanted that. They wanted Oprah stuff. They said, go back to telling us how to get new cars and things. And Neville's manager or booking agent and so on said, you're killing it, man. And Neville said, I will preach this to the empty walls. That's how much he was invested in this. So ultimately, it's a doctrine about the becoming one with God. But the first step is the law, which is proving to yourself that your imagination is more powerful than.
So you have to kind of believe in it first. That's the key.
Yeah, but you have to start by believing it, but the point is it will prove itself to you. You will have that proof. He says the only proof a modern man will accept, and this goes back to Watts and Spengler and Burroughs and Crowley and all these people, the only proof that a modern man will accept is an empirical experience. And if we can produce that, then people will have a solid basis for their religious beliefs, their spiritual beliefs. Right. We're done with faith. We're done with just believing in dogma. Watts has this three-step thing, the Spenglerian thing. You start with the Catholic Church, where it's all about faith and dogma, all about believing dogma, and then you have the Protestants who say, no, it has to be this religious, personal religious faith. But we're beyond that now. We need empirical proof, and or looking at it another way. It's, oh my goodness, we used to be in the golden age, but now we're in the Kali Yuga and everything's terrible. Well, what's appropriate to the Kali Yuga? What's appropriate to the Kali Yuga is empirical proof. So for Avila, rather than just sitting around waiting for the end, it's the Kali Yuga. Well, you should have a spiritual practice that's appropriate to the Kali Yuga. What's that? Materialism.
I don't know if you get into like Rudolf Steiner, and but I was like I did a show a while back, and it's interesting because like how theosophy is actually much more compatible with hereditarian thinking as opposed to like the idea of like ironically like really rigid Christian view on salvation is more it's really based upon a blank slateism. Like, do you agree, and do you see like some irony in that?
Well, I don't know much about the theosophy, although I've sort of like nibbled around the edges of it.
I guess
What I
like this
do.
is like a philosophical concept like I've thought of, but I'm saying like it's sort of like the Christian view on salvation is sort of based upon like a blank slate. So because everyone is very much shaped by our biology and circumstances, which is hereditarian, then they do kind of need like their own spiritual path to God, and also to kind of be judged upon like their unique traits. So it's kind of like a anti-egalitarian, but also a more pluralist way to look at things.
This is a good example of what we were talking about at the beginning, about how these things sound like they're new agey, but they're also rightist. Because I know what I do know is Spengler talks about different races, and he gets this, of course,
And
from
Steiner, like
theosophy.
Rudolf Steiner's view of like spiritual race and theosophy too.
Yeah. So here's the thing. So Steiner is perhaps most known today among ordinary people for these schools, these Waldorf schools. And, NPR listening, hippy-dippy,
yeah, and there's been like
parents.
A push. They've been targeted by like cancel culture because
exactly.
of the background.
Right, because they're racist, right?
But they're
Because
usually, I think they're like upper class kind of white liberals who are kind of
right, exactly.
New agey.
Because the upper age white, these upper age, upper class white liberals, hippy dippy types think, oh, we should have a hippy dippy advanced progressive school for our children, not some horrible public school. So they send them to the Waldorf schools, and the children start learning about races, right? So this becomes very, very tough. So, I mean, this is an example of what you were saying before. Someone who was, a really far out spiritual guy, like Rudolf Steiner, really wacky, if you will, nevertheless, in modern terms, turns out to be a terrible racist. The National Socialists, clamped down on Theosophists and Anthroposophists.
I think he didn't really fit into neatly into the left versus right binary because
exactly,
he was outspoken
exactly.
against like the rise exactly. of the Nazis.
Yeah, exactly. There's a book somebody just wrote recently defending Steiner from the charge of being an anti-Semite and so on. I mean, all this stuff goes back and forth and back and forth. But the thing of it is that here you can see that, traditionalism, is sort of like New Age, and it's sort of not like New Age. If you really read the traditionalists like Gaidon and Abel is obviously, fascist, but if you look at Gaidon and so these other guys, they don't like to talk about Abel. When I was reading the traditionalists, I never even knew anything about Abel. They never mentioned it. There was this one book review by Titus Burkhardt of Ride the Tiger. That I came across, and he was, of course, Abel is nonsense. He's evil. He's terrible. He's a Nazi, and so on. Right? This is a traditionalist talking. So that was the official view about Abel. So today we just lump them all together. Oh, they're all traditionalists. You were not supposed to talk about Abel among traditionalists. But on the other hand, if you look at Schwann and Gaidon and so on, their stuff is hardly hippy dippy stuff. So in terms of cancel culture, these guys all fall into the same basket. My point of view then was from the start was, well, if they're all going to be called Nazis, I might as well read the Nazis. I might as well read Abel, right? Instead of these other guys who are just sort of like pretending not to be. Let's get into the real hardcore stuff. And that's in Abel. That's a reduction.
William Burroughs is another interesting one because he was a beatnik, but he became popular with counterculture and even Hollywood with the movie made out of Naked Lunch. I think that was some time in the 90s, may have been in the 90s, but.
Yeah, late 90s.
Right. So, but he's interesting because there's different angles to him because he was definitely like an extreme hedonist and would be viewed as like a total degenerate by any like conservative or traditional moral viewpoints.
Oh, yeah.
But he's also very much kind of a libertarian, like an extreme anarchist. But also he kind of reminded me a bit of like the Marquis de Sade's philosophy of just do what feels great, good to you, regardless of like the moral outcomes or impacts on others. And he very much had this view of being kind of suffocated by society that was kind of keeping him down. But then on top of that, he had this, I have actually read Naked Lunch. It is extremely like hypnagogic and surreal, but he actually created his own like metaphysical like realm that he believed in.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, first of all, he would have been very upset to hear you call him a beatnik. Because
he rejected that label is more than
well he rejected the label he wasn't and he wasn't a
the
beatnik.
Like journalists referred to him as a beatnik, but he rejected
journalists say a lot of stuff
right of course yeah
but he was the elder spokesman. He was from an earlier generation. He was teaching Kerouac and Ginsberg in New York in Columbia. By that time he was already a longtime drug addict and freak of various sorts. He used to give them books. He made them read Spengler. Now there's a right winger for you, right? He was telling them to read Spengler. that's where he was getting his ideas from. There's a clue as to what his beliefs are. On a more practical level, of course, he was a gun fanatic, which is not really a hippie sort of thing. Of course, these things, people like this always get a pass. You know, they get grandfathered in.
He hasn't been a target of counterculture. Maybe being like a LGBTQ icon has helped somewhat, but he actually hasn't really been. I don't think he's been a target of cancel culture yet. Like, I've read Naked Lunch, like some of the, I think like the sexual stuff is the most outrageous in that.
Oh, yeah.
But it's so surreal. That's the thing. It's like a fever dream.
Well, on the LGBT front, you see, if there's one book I know of called Queer Burroughs. And if you actually look at what Burroughs says in interviews, particularly, he's not really very politically correct about queers, as he likes to call it. You know, his idea of homosexuality is a sort of like a hyper macho sort of thing. And throughout all of his writings, you know, queers, fags, transvestites, and so on are all figures of fun, mockery, are sinister, and so on. You know, the traditional, you know, sinister transvestite and all that. Burroughs was all for that. He despised fags and femmes and so on, which is kind of ironic because apparently in the bedroom he was quite a femme. Which really freaked people out. got that close to him. You know, he also did an imitation of Crowley with a falsetto. he was very old school in that way, which one maybe not that doesn't pick up on in his writing because you just normally think, oh yeah, he's queer, he's pro queer and so on. He's pro some queers. but not all of them. It's kind of interesting. I mean, you know, Burroughs, with his characters that are subject to undergo instantaneous transformations and so on and things like that, it sounds like he would be at home with transsexualism and transhumanism and so on, but it's not all that clear that that he would approve of that kind of thing. He certainly doesn't like drag queens. He certainly doesn't like femmes. Would he like transsexuals? Would he like the whole idea of gender fluidity? You know, in theory, he would, you know, because, you know, he's Burroughs.
Well, it's almost
you know?
Like he would view that as like more Naked Lunch. It's very much like every character is almost like they're like less than human. They're more like symbols or objects. Like you don't feel like there are all these like grotesque things happening, but you don't really feel any like emotional attachment to any of them.
The key thing is that he doesn't have any characters because everyone is subject to instantaneous and complete transformation of something. Which is the terrifying aspect.
Like, what is it? Like, it's been a while since I read it, but I think people turn into these, like, giant, like, insects.
Yeah, giant centipedes. And
right.
Yeah. But here's the thing. More dogmatically speaking or theoretically speaking, the thing about Burroughs that goes back to what you said about Watts, when you talked about Watts rejecting scripts, Burroughs was all about rejecting control. He was obsessed with the idea
of Watts was, too, like, control.
Yeah, exactly.
Like almost like you could even say like the Marquis de Sade might be the extreme of that, but then there's just a view like there's just so much bullshit and arbitrary control in society, like life scripts and bureaucracy and critique of that. And maybe, I mean, today I think you get that more from the right, but it used to be kind of a hippie thing because I remember Bernie Sanders, who's considered very progressive, he got flack for saying when he was younger, Bernie Sanders actually wrote sensitive young men are being oppressed in school by like these teachers who referred to them as like old bitches. So that's like, so I think just think there's, yeah, that's total Burroughs, but I think there's been such a paradigm shift. So a lot of people we think of as of the left would say things that are considered right wing now.
Oh, exactly. And Burroughs was obsessed with control. So that's the one key element in all of his writings and so on. Which gets back to what I was saying before about practicality. He was all about trying to find some practical way to get to find out who's doing the control and break that control and take control of it. That's why that's what the cutoffs were supposed to be. He was interested in, of course, crank stuff like Scientology and Wilhelm Reich and people like that. But it was all about, control. And in a way, I haven't seen this in print. No one's dared to put this in print yet. So I haven't seen a consistent argument. Some people think that there's a Jewish element, that when he's talking about these extraterrestrial creatures taking over the planet and instilling control and all that, and taking over our minds. So when he's really talking about Jews, I don't know if that's true or not, but it's interesting. You could maybe go that way. And that's another way in which
I don't know. I think some people just, they read into everything.
Some people read that into everything. You know, there's a Jew under my bed. There's a Jew in my sandwich, and so on.
Like Kafka was Jewish and very much into Kabbalah, but very similar themes. I'm not really sure what his relation with, because I think Kafka writes a lot about the oppression of bureaucracy in a surreal sense. He was interested in both the Kabbalah, but also actually like European kind of like pagan mysticism as well. So that's like interesting.
Yeah, actually, I have a piece on Countercurrents somewhere about Kafka as an Aryan sort of writer. I can't think of the name of it, but it's a review of a book that somebody came out with recently. Not so recently now, it'd probably be about 2016, 2017 or something like that.
I mean, if you write a book, Kabbalah as like Aryan mysticism, that's going to get a lot of insane responses.
Yeah, well, there is a book called The Greek Kabbalah spelled with the...
Yeah, I think that might be true, because it's kind of like, it's kind of a cliche of like right-wing anti-Semites will say, oh, we have these Kabbalistic elites. But it's interesting is that it's always been, Kabbalah is interesting because it was influenced by a lot of like pagan non-Abrahamic influences. So like in places like Spain and Morocco from like Sufism. And then I think in the early Middle Ages, like around the year 1100, there was some influence, actually European paganism got influenced some of the early like Jewish sects.
Yeah, well, I mean, the idea along those lines is that the Kabbalah is simply a Jewish appropriation of Neoplatonism. So it's really Neoplatonism. Also, Abela maintained that the Neoplatonism, the Christian, well, not Christian, the Western esoteric tradition, in order to hide from the Christian inquisitors and so on, as early as the 800s, that Western esotericism was hidden with the rabbis. So that in order to recover, so in other words, there's Western esotericism, and then this Christianity stuff came in, which for Abel is a alien tradition that has nothing to do with mysticism at all, really. And then the real Western mystical tradition doesn't go through Christianity. It's hidden among the rabbis and then reemerged in the Renaissance. So Avila actually, doesn't buy any of this, the wonderful Judeo-Christian tradition in the West and so on. He thinks it went from the Greeks through the rabbis, into the Renaissance, which is an interesting idea. I don't know if it's true, but, that would indicate.
Oh, like alchemy, like the popularity of alchemy at that time.
Yeah. I mean, that's why Avila was willing to read and make use of Jewish Kabbalistic texts and so on. He wasn't like, oh, this is the Jews, it's terrible. No, Abel himself studied their writings because he thought that's where the actual Western tradition was found. It didn't come from the Jews, but it was hidden among the Jews, because the Christians, which was another kind of Judaism, we're running around burning stuff and burning.
This goes to that kind of this trend where all the Abrahamic faiths have some mystical component. Like you have Islam has Sufism, and Christianity has like Christian mystics. Then you have the Kabbalah. There's always this duality with all the Abrahamic faiths.
Yeah, there's always a duality. Here's a little nugget of traditionalist wisdom for your listeners. People always talk about the esoteric and exoteric, and there's the dogmatic exoteric, and then there's the hidden mystical esotericism. But that's not how it actually works, according to Guénon. It's different in different traditions. So that in the Chinese tradition, there's actually two different traditions. There's the exoteric Confucianism, and then there's the mystical Taoism. So Taoism isn't the hidden core of Confucianism or anything like that. In Islam, Sufism is not esoteric Islam, he said. It was Islamic esotericism. I think I have that right. In other words, Giorgiani says essentially the same thing, that the Sufis had to cover their mysticism with this layer of Islam because otherwise they'd be persecuted. But it doesn't emerge out of Islam. It's not really part of Islam. In fact, most Orthodox Muslims consider Sufis to be heretics anyway. But they had to use the language of the Quran in order to escape persecution. It's only in Christianity, because of the factors we've been talking about, that mysticism is sort of like hidden inside of the tradition. You get that in Neville. You know, he's giving a mystical reading of the Bible, which is very interesting, because even the most, you know, historical, he says the Bible has no history in it and none of the people in it are real, which of course is not quite true. I mean, Caesar was real and so on. But, but basically that's his point. It's a psychological or Kabbalistic document using the language of history, which is actually a very modern point of view. It's kind of interesting.
Another writer you mentioned is Colin Wilson,
yeah,
who is associated more with the angry young men literary genre equivalent of the British equivalent of the Beats, though actually some people would kind of dispute that label. And then mm-hmm. he wrote The Outsiders, which is about like alienation and creative types, but in a very kind of like more Nietzschean sense. But yeah. I think what he's like most known for is his writings on the concept of consciousness. And there are actually may seem like more, I think he's like more practical than Neville Goddard, but with Colin Wilson, he talks, and it's interesting because, like, I actually, in 2002, I have obviously never met him, but I lived about a half hour away from him, which is kind of interesting. But, like, with Colin Wilson, like, he talks about, like, how to kind of, not so much about, like, he had some interest in, like, the supernatural, but a lot of practical, and he was an incredibly prolific writer, but, like, really practical advice on how to expand, like, the full sense of consciousness and the, like, peak consciousness is the word we used to describe, like, the full human experience.
Right. Well, again, he would dispute the idea of it being a beatnik, but he would also dispute the idea of being an angry young man. He rejected that notion.
And I think, again, like, even with kind of, like, the beatniks, that was more of a concoction by the media.
Exactly, exactly. And particularly in Colin Wilson's case, or the angry young men, it's an interesting book he published called The Angry Years, which is his summing up and settling accounts with that. It's a very amusing book because basically he just goes through all the angry young men and points out how they you know, ran out of things to write about and became drunkards and dropped dead and so on, and they had all these terrible lives. But I'm still here, ha ha, you know, as you see the implications. So he outlived them all. They all became failures of one sort or another. But anyway, yeah. So as he says, it was just created by journalists to lump all these people together, and they really had very little to do with each other. And that's why when he's even already with his second book, a review of which is in my book, Religion and the Rebel, that was his second book after The Outsider, which was pumped up by the journalists, you know, oh, this brilliant young man and so on. And then he published his second book, Religion and the Rebel, and they decided, well, it's time to take him down a peg. They all attacked him as a autodidact.
Like, he became super famous overnight with The Outsider. Yeah. Then there was some weird thing where his father-in-law or someone like found some weird like serial killer writings, and it went to the media and the police, and that destroyed his reputation, something like that.
He went to the media and the police, and he also went to Wilson's apartment with a stick or a belt or something, and said something like, "I'm here to deal with you, Wilson," or something, some Victorian thing.
Right.
Like that. It was very very ridiculous.
Yeah, with his writings, I think he was interested in both like Crowley and mysticism, and then also he was influenced by H.P. Lovecraft, and then politically he had some. He actually had some ties early on with to Mosley, but he doesn't strike me as like overly political. That angle was interesting. He did have some ties with Mosley, and I think Mosley even reviewed The
Yeah,
Outsider.
you can find that on Countercurrents, actually, the Mosley's review. They reprinted that. Ties is maybe too close, when talking about these political people and so on. I mean, he wasn't ever a member of
I
Ties
think
or anything.
off best way to go about is the not being overtly political. These people, what really fascinate me, they come at it more from like the creative or philosophical side, and then they kind of discover these ideas that, like, the cliche term would be like they become like quote unquote based kind of on their own rather than get this like indoctrinated, like, I'm on team red or team blue and all that bullshit.
Yeah. But at the time of the Mosley stuff and so on, Wilson and Bill Hopkins, who was certainly an elitist, and so on, they were sort of like, yeah. I mean, the thing is that what we've been calling them is like spiritual elitists and so on. And to a certain extent, they were social elitists as well, because that kind of goes with it. Because society should identify these people and support them, these mystical, and so they would have the they were having like little meetings and political things and so on, and the journalist got a hold of it and said, oh, Colin Wilson and Bill Hopkins are planning to a neo-Nazi revolution or something and so on. It's just one
Right, like
ridiculous thing.
Wilson, other than the early correspondence of Mosley, he doesn't strike me as political at all. Maybe he was like a tepid Tory.
Colin Wilson?
Yeah.
Something like that. I mean, I think he probably thought of himself as
Maybe he
being
did, like,
something
he
more
did
liberal.
benefit from the 60s counterculture as far as some of the interest in his subject matter. That doesn't mean that he, like, supported them.
Oh, no. I
Did, like, there was, like, in England after the war, there was this embrace of like extreme utilitarianism and kind of like rationalism and like petty bourgeois values. And then
Yeah.
same with like Lovecraft. Like, someone like H.P. Lovecraft probably like would have hated the hippies, but after his death, like, there was this revival or interest in his work during that 60s counterculture.
Well, the thing that infuriated Wilson about England in the 50s and 60s, and even always, England as such, the reason why he preferred America was that the British, they thought they were too sophisticated for big ideas, that anybody talked about big ideas.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think there could be some truth to that because, like, the French are stereotyped as being like putting a lot of value on creativity, arts, and philosophy. The Americans are kind of like I think the downside of America is like the economic commodification of everything, but America does have this kind of exceptional like Promethean spirit. But so
Right.
there is like the stereotype of like the British having this kind of like narrow-minded like middle class values, which I mean, it's probably based on truth compared to other countries.
Well, and with reference to the angry young men, Wilson would say that the angry young men were these post-war guys. The war was over and they were supposed to be the winners, and they came back to England and it was the same old elitist, hierarchical bullshit and so on. And their response was to mock and denigrate culture and so on. In other words, listening to Mozart, well, that's what some toffee-nosed upper class
But I
twit
think
would do,
Wilson,
and
it
so on.
doesn't
So.
strike me. I think Wilson, that doesn't necessarily strike me of how Wilson saw it. I think he had a lot of appreciation for the classics.
That's what I'm saying. That
If anything, I'd say like
the angry young
Wilson,
men, the
I
reason he
think Wilson
wasn't.
was probably influenced. Maybe he's been described as existentialist, but I think he's actually more influenced by like the 19th century, like the first half of the 19th century, like you had like Romanticism.
Well, you see, but that's the point I'm making, that Wilson was not an angry young man. What he said was that the angry young men were these guys who reacted to the crumbling British aristocracy by identifying culture with that kind of aristocracy and therefore mocking it as outsiders. You mentioned 19th century romanticism. Well, that's exactly what they would consider to be bullshit. You know, oh, that 19th century romanticism, eh, Wilson? And, you know, he talks particularly about Kingsley Amis as someone who got locked into this attitude from his first novel, Lucky Jim, of just being an outsider mocking these stuck-up culture people, and therefore having no culture, being unable to take over that culture, to acquire it. They just sat around mocking it, you know. And you know, you find that among the punks, for instance, in England and so on.
I guess this idea of like the sort of a creative cast as like the natural aristocracy or like aristocratic radicalism or individualism. And I guess like there is this special, like creative types as this class that are being suppressed by like modern Western society, or like the artist as a caste suppressed by managerialism or kind of mercantile values, liberal capitalism. And I think that's been like a huge theme with a lot of thinkers you've covered. So like this idea of like how to kind of liberate this caste, and some like solutions might be like the social credit idea, or like economic, of like C.H. Douglas, economic patronage, like the need for leisure. And it kind of explains like, so like Oscar Wilde, he supported socialism, but for culturally elitist reasons. But like all these thinkers, like Wynnham Lewis, Oscar Wilde, H.P. Lovecraft, Colin Wilson, Ezra Pound, I think like a lot of them envisioned like the artist as like this aristocratic type cast. And like, that's really the contrast with like the 60s counterculture. I think it had more of a negative impact because it was like this egalitarian individualism, but that was easily co-opted by like big institutions and like by like big capitalism. And I think there is sort of a downside in like the downside in like nonconformity for the sake of it, because I don't really see it like for the masses. And there are limitations to that kind of individualism. The theme is like these thinkers, they have like skepticism of like commercial values. And so, yeah, like that is kind of like, that is like a major theme. And I think it even applies to someone like Salvador, like Dali, who he was an artist with interest in like mysticism, but some skepticism of modernity at the same time. But how would you kind of like sum up that concept and how it relates to these thinkers?
Their individualism was a response to hierarchies that were insufficient.
Or was it a response? Like in the 20th century, you had the kind of stodgy old aristocracy, or the hereditary kind of old money, the hereditary like old families, and then you had like this new like mercantile elite that was in the managerial class that was arising. And I think a lot of these thinkers saw themselves as like the true cultural elite, but they felt really like really kind of oppressed and pushed aside. And that theme is very relevant today, but I think it really reflected a lot of thinkers of the 20th century, even like the later part of the 19th century.
Well, look at these guys. So supposedly they're all like individualists and all that. But really what they're doing is that they're separating themselves from the existing culture, and they're trying to find some alternative culture. Now, if you look at all these guys, they all seem to be dealing with some non-orthodox canon. So you have Watts, who became interested as a teenager in Oriental philosophy. And you have Colin Wilson, who's interested in 19th century romanticism and so on. You have Neville, who's interested in Blake and the Bible, basically. He said those were his only two books. Crowley tried to rediscover magic through ancient writings and Kabbalah and so on. They're all proclaiming themselves to be individualists vis-a-vis their existing culture, but what they actually want is to be a part of some other kind of culture. So their individualism is sort of provisional or relative.
I mean, maybe it seems like a cope, but it's like you could say it's like an aristocratic individualism, you could be successful or you could be alienated from society, but the sense that you have this grand vision to reshape society could be like a narcissistic sense. You're not part of the collective, but it's very different than just liberal individualism.
Yeah. I mean, if you're part of this, of a spiritual elite, then it's alongside or underneath or in a different dimension and so on than the existing social hierarchy. So it sort of like fades in and out as to whether you're a member of the elite or not. You're not a member of the political elite or the social elite, perhaps, but on the other hand, you're a member of the spiritual elite. You know, Crowley, you know, came from a rich family, but they were, you know, religiously odd. They were members of an apocalyptic Protestant cult, so they weren't Church of England or anything like that. And he eventually made himself into the wickedest man in the world, but that was because he had become a master magician through his contacts with the secret chiefs in Tibet and so on. So there's the alternate hierarchy, you know. So he's, I mean, that's a kind of, you know, ultimate status, the wickedest man in the world, right? He's on top of the heap, you know. He's reached the top of the pyramid. But it's not the standard social pyramid. I think all these people have kind of, you know, Burroughs' family was a minor branch of the Burroughs adding machine family. Modest amount of wealth.
Or yeah, even H.P. Lovecraft, like he came from an old money
exactly.
family, but they lost it. But it does
right.
show you, like, Americans have this obsession with, like, being self-made. But I actually think, I mean, I think a lot of that is actually bullshit. I think a lot of times, like, you need sort of, like, cultural and spiritual elitism, but then you also need, like, the patronage, like, American value. I think the American concept of meritocracy is idea of, like, being a self-made man economically, I think it's been a disaster.
Yeah.
Not just like today. It's not like one of these people who say everything about America was great until like the recent like liberal woke changes. I think there's been like fundamental flaws there from way back.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of my ongoing themes that has nothing particularly to do with mysticism, but another theme that I've been exploring in writings for Countercurrents and so on, particularly about movies and television, is the con man is the essential American archetype.
Right, right. Or yeah, with Trump, like yeah, I mean,
well,
that
Trump,
applies
yeah.
to Trump, and that's kind of the appeal. That's kind of the appeal to him.
Exactly, exactly. He's the ultimate American con man. You seen this so called mugshot that they're
yeah, I have up? Yeah. It's like I think people are saying it looks like a consistent theme of like characters in Stanley Kubrick movies.
Yes, yeah. Well, and rightly so. Just referring to Stanley Kubrick movies, right? It looks like something from a movie. It's not a mugshot. They claim it's a mug. There's no mug. This is Miles Mathis territory. Miles Mathis is always pointing out these mugshots that obviously aren't mugshots because they got people wearing hats or they're standing the wrong way.
Right,
mugshots
right.
Are standardized. Right, they're standardized. Nobody's but where's the little chalkboard underneath his neck with the details on? Right, where's the profile shot? Why is it color? Why is he staring at the camera like a Stanley Kubrick villain? You know, it's the most obvious. If you didn't think that the whole Trump thing was a con right from the beginning, you have to think it's a con now. I mean, they're just it's in your face.
Right,
this is the standard. This is the last move. The standard last move of the con is the revelation of the method. Right? He shows you his hand. He shows you what he's done. And then he smiles, as Poe says, Edgar Allan Poe. The con, you know, Poe's story, Diddling is a Fine Art. The diddler at night lies down and smiles. Right? There's always that last little smirk, and that's what you got with the Trump mugshot. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. I mean, the whole thing is up. The whole thing now. I
or
believe
deep,
the whole
thing. It
fake.
Looks almost like a deep fake. Yeah, I have like a new book out, Vaporfornia. It's a sequel to my first book, Journey to Vapor Island. You reviewed the first book, and
I did.
You made some comparisons to Confederacy of Dunces, William S. Burroughs, and angry young men like Kingsley Amis, and you said it takes basic alt-right tropes, the alienation, but it transcends into a magical miserabilism. Did you get a chance to look over the second book?
I have not.
Okay, so.
But I wanted to say, but I felt bad about that. So I took a look at a review that somebody wrote on Goodreads. So it's on Goodreads. Here you go. And they said something that I thought was interesting, that you write about, and this is true. It seems like it's very much like the first book. It's a different version, which is okay, because as you know from my movie reviews, I love repetition. There's nothing wrong with that. It's very much like the first book in a way. But anyway, this guy says you write about a world that's waiting for a messiah to save them, instead of relying on their own imaginations. And that seems to indicate that your new book is very much in line with what we've been talking about.
Yeah, I mean, that's so insightful, because what's interesting is I wrote this long before I had any interest in new thought thinkers like Neville Goddard. It's pretty, I don't know if I want to like boast and say like, oh, I'm a genius or something. Like Colin Wilson kind of did that, and that pisses people off. But actually, like, I mostly wrote this back in, like, 2018, 2019. And I didn't really get interested in new thought until last year, 2022.
Oh, okay.
But basically, to kind of give some interesting – so you have Roger Blackstone, and he's running for president, and he could be – some comparisons to, like, Elon Musk or Donald Trump. But I think maybe, like, he symbolizes, like, the hope of what those people – should be, but like transcends way beyond them. And then he has like this kind of this political philosophy of restructuring society based on aesthetics, but also interested, he's for like universal basic income, but in the sense of like valuing kind of like more leisure and creativity. And I think he is fundamentally like Blackstone. He may support like some left-wing ideas, but he is fundamentally like an elitist, and there is this kind of alchemy and dualism between like the protagonist dreams. And then there are these like various, like there's like this occult figure in California. So it is like alchemy or new thought, and like the concept of like these alternative futures and existing as parallel universes. And then the protagonist, Max, he's like the kind of loser or loner archetype, but becoming more kind of empowered, or in a sense of like aristocratic radicalism. And then this billionaire presidential candidate like Blackstone actually like meets with him and tells him he can change the world like via his thoughts. And it's very surreal, almost in the sense of Burroughs, even maybe not quite, but it takes place in modern day California, and a lot of like dark humor and like satire of contemporary politics. But then it is very, a lot of relevance to like occultism and the mystics. And I'd say even like thinkers in your book.
Yeah. Blackstone, even from the first book, I think Blackstone is like the Trump we deserve.
Right.
But I think the same guy talked about, your interest in archaeo futurism and so on, or alternative timelines.
I mean, it's been a long time since you reviewed the first book. Did you get any of those like new thought type themes? Like the power imagination from the first book, even. And I wrote that way back in like 2016, 2017, long before I had any interest in this kind of stuff.
I may have. I was talking about magical miserabilism.
Right.
I don't recall specifically, but I'm just.
I think I remember the first book, the protagonist named Gnome. He writes a manifesto, then he
carries
out this horrific act, and when he gets out of prison much later in the future, the entire world is transformed by his manifesto. So
what I picked up on. Yeah, exactly. So it's as if ordinarily you might be put away in prison for the rest of your life, but in this imaginary sort of world, he actually gets out, and the world has been transformed. Well, I just wanted to make a note on this, that in regards to what we were talking, these people we've been talking about before, Burroughs, his interest in the cut-up technique was that he believed that words determined what the future was. And if you cut the words, the future leaks out, as he says. And this recalls also Neville, who talked about having a four-dimensional view of the world, in which he explicitly linked to what in the 40s was beginning to leak out about quantum mechanics and so on. He said, in future, physicists will explain why we live in a four-dimensional world, but what's important is to use it. And so the idea is that if we're not restricted to this three-dimensional world around us, we have an access to a fourth dimension by means of which we can reach in and change the world.
What you describe sounds like the concept of the vapor in my book, basically.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at, yeah.
And I wasn't even aware of that. Interesting, yeah.
Well, you know, as these things leap out, Mitch Horowitz talks about how the new thought writers seemed like they're influenced by people like Hegel and Plotinus and so on, but it was impossible for them to be because they didn't have access in, you know, rural America and so on in the 19th century to any of these writings, which makes it more interesting because it's like the idea just keeps popping up. You know, you don't have to read it in somebody's book and say, oh, you know, now I'm a Hegelian, now I'm a Neoplatonist. No, it just arrives, which is, of course, because it's true.
Or like that idea that, like, all these, like, there's like a collective knowledge that's stored in all our subconsciousness. Like that idea.
Although that's a very elaborate version of it. You might just say it's because it's just true. You know, you just have to open your eyes and look around. You know, again, getting through the idea of scripts and control and so on, or Watts talking about, you know, breaking out of the Western mindset and all that, and Colin Wilson.
Or like, another thing is like these like psychological like prisons and barriers that we're put in, or we put ourselves in, and just like letting go. And it makes me think of kind of like, or constraints, like even with like politics, like I guess the idea of like how new thought could lead to like radical politics is because we have constraints in society, like the concept of the Overton window. And I guess new thought, when you think anything is possible, that could be basically, that removes all restraints, like including like the Overton window.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're not, I guess somebody could use new thought to, reinstitute African slavery or something, or, you know, something along those lines. You know, I mean, it's kind of like a neutral in that sense. So, I mean, you could imagine.
Well, it's neutral.
You could imagine,
it's,
you know, neutral.
Neutral in a sense, but also doesn't have any barriers. So anyone could do it to push their own ideology.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's the sort of thing that, I first read about in Jocelyn Godwin's book, Arctos, the myth of the polar myth and Nazi survival or something like that. And you find that in Giorgiani's books and so on, you know, this notion of what Godwin calls Nazi spirituality. these new age ideas are equally available to any political persuasion. Giorgiani, for instance, seems to, you know, what he began to get in trouble with was when he began suggesting that, you know, because parapsychology is real and all the New Age people are cheering, yeah, parapsychology, says, well, therefore, there are all these problems that would arise, and therefore, we need a strong government to control things. And they go, ooh.
It's interesting because I interviewed Giorgiani, and he actually said, almost sounded more like a leftist. I think what he said, in this future of parapsychology where we can read everyone's mind, we have to kind of embrace like this more liberal, like left humanitarian view where it's like socialist, but we have to treat everyone with love and compassion. I think he ended up saying something like that because of parapsychology. Like Giorgiani's one of those thinkers, I think he's brilliant, but it's very like hard to kind of just explain his concepts in layman's terms. Like to someone, like to, you can't really explain it to someone with like an IQ of like 90.
Yeah, well, I'm out of luck then, I guess. But that's what I'm talking. That's what we've been talking about. You know, these things sort of like transcend these barriers. I mean, think, you know, depending on his audience, he can probably present it in a acceptable leftist sort of view, or depending on his audience, he could start. You know, I mean, you know, if you're interested in UFOs, for instance, you can take one route and start talking about, you know, peace and love from the messengers from the stars and so on. Or you could take the National Socialist road and start talking about, you know, Nazi UFOs and Antarctic bases and so on. So depending on your audience, you can tailor your message in various ways. My memory of the book, Prometheus and Atlas, was that was his argument that we needed, you know, what Heidegger called the truth of and greatness of National Socialism and so on was the fact, among other things, that they took seriously what kind of state you would need to have if parapsychology was real, you know, where people could read everyone's thoughts and people could control reality and so on. Well, geez, we don't want everyone to have that ability.
Or yeah, like I think like the whole like debate about like AI and transhumanism, right, like what kind of society, like, could it lead to like a really authoritarian,
right,
society? It probably will take down modern liberalism, but the question is like what replaces it? Could end up being much worse, but who knows, maybe some positive could come from it.
I don't know if it's Giorgiani or someone else who was talking along these lines that you know, if the official liberal position is we shouldn't have anything to do with genetic engineering because you know, reasons, the Chinese are just going to go ahead anyway.
Right, right.
And therefore, they're going to win. So we're going to live in a Chinese social credit, in the bad sense, kind of authoritarian system.
Not C.H. Douglas.
Yeah, exactly. The other kind. So that's the idea. I mean, you can't take like a libertarian or a hippie sort of, well, whatever happens, you know, or a capitalist sort of, well, whatever makes the most money, you know. No, it's not going to work that way because the authoritarian people are going to get serious about this and take over.
Right, right. That's exactly what would happen if people are not like hyper vigilant about these things. Like we're getting close to the end of the show. Before we wrap up, James, do you want to like plug this book, A Mysticism, and your other book, A Movie Reviews? And then also, do you see like any positive signs in like the art right scene taking off? And like, do you expect to see like a kind of revival in mysticism?
Okay. Well, everyone should go out and buy my books, Mysticism After Modernism. You can get it on Amazon. You can also get it from the website of the publisher, Manticore Press in Australia. I have a more recent book, which is called Passing the Buck, Coleman Francis and Other Cinematic Metaphysicians, which is taking a different tack.
It's about themes of metaphysics in cinema.
Yeah, yeah. Or a metaphysical approach to cinema, if you will. It has many movie reviews.
Can you name a number of like films and directors that are mentioned? Like, I'm curious. Like, do you mention like David Lynch, for instance?
Actually, I don't.
Okay, because you think that, like, you think like metaphysics, surrealism, and cinema has to be David Lynch.
Yeah, I should look at that. Greg Johnson has done a number of Lynch reviews. It might be his favorite director, possibly. So he's pretty well covered that ground, I think. I prefer to look at obscure directors, particularly directors of B movies or bad movies. And the sort of centerpiece in this work is a review of the Coleman Francis trilogy, The Beast of Yucca Flats, The Skydivers, and Red Zone Cuba. Three bottom of the barrel films made from in the early 60s that I think are very, very unique, and they're well worth studying. They're boring films. As I was mentioning before, I don't have any problem with repetition. They're extremely boring. They're extremely ugly. They're extremely, you know, His films are existentialist in a way that Sartre and other people only dream about being. They're hard to describe. So take a look. Take a look at it. The theme, passing the buck, is the basic metaphysical theme is the idea of people surmounting karma by palming it off on other people. And only after writing the book did I discover that some French critics have attributed this to Alfred Hitchcock, that in his, many of his films take that form where bad guys pass off their bad karma onto innocent people and thereby achieve enlightenment. So it gets back to the idea of mysticism and enlightenment being outside of the morality and bad people becoming Buddhas. So there's a lot of stuff in these bad movies if you spend a lot of time watching them, as I do. Do I see a rebirth of mysticism? Well,
I guess mysticism, a revival in like mysticism, and then also your thoughts on this scene, the art right, if you're familiar with it.
Oh, the art right. Oh, that's even more interesting. It continues. Can't think of anything off the top of my head at the moment, but let's first address the question of a revival of mysticism. There may be something to it because there's, I think, more and more scientific study of it, which you can find in recent books by Mitch Horowitz and also books by Dean Radin, or however his name is pronounced, R-A-D-I. It's a recent book called Real Magic. About the scientific study of telepathy and hypnagogic states and things like that. Also the work of Bernardo Castro on what he calls analytic idealism, which is sort of revival of 19th century idealism in terms of quantum mechanics. Very interesting and very good metaphysical understanding of why new thought is possible. He doesn't seem to believe in new thought, but he admits it's possible and he can explain why it works. So if you're interested in why magic could work, I would recommend that. I don't know what to say about the art right. I guess I'm kind of, out of touch with artistic circles these days. Everybody I look at is old, like, Dali and so on. Very interested in Hungarian filmmaker, Béla Tarr. He makes 7-hour films, black and white films. He has a film that is 2.5 hours long and only has 17 scenes, 17 shots. So it's like the Copa scene from Goodfellas, but over and over again. That's an area I'm interested in exploring. I don't know if it's art right. I think Mr. Tarr is very much a leftist, but as we've seen before, art tends to go in its own direction.
I guess the kind of explanation is it used to be like maybe 5 to 10 years ago, everything was overtly political, and there has been this very positive shift of people sort of have gotten jaded and cynical about politics and focusing more on creative endeavors, which is good.
Oh yeah, that's good. I don't offhand think of anything that seems very positive along the lines of an alternative form of art. The thing, you look at these movies that come out these days and they all seem to suck. And I think people are becoming increasingly aware of that. There's whole genres of YouTube and so on, people A-logging all this Hollywood crap. And it doesn't, contrary to what the libertarians would tell us, it's not about get woke, go broke, because they don't go broke. They have unlimited sources of money, as the social credit people would tell us.
That's a whole other tangent, but I think that's interesting. Is like go woke, go broke. I think for the right wing, it's a total cope. But this kind of this whole sort of change in the economic system, relating to kind of like talked about social credit, where profit, where it's sort of like like the whole capitalism versus socialism thing in both sides, like the Reaganites versus like the Bernie people, and it's like they're stuck in that old dichotomy. There's this thing where like it's not even like profits are not even everything, where they're just like the government, it's sort of like the Federal Reserve prints all this money and then they use it to like prop up the stock markets of like a handful of like mega corporations.
Well, expecting, Hollywood to give people what they want is like expecting the political system to give people what they want. I mean, you got the Democrats or Republicans, and you've got the same Hollywood crap. They'll just shove it out, and as long as somebody is watching it. I mean, what somebody said was, it's not supposed to be for you legacy, white people. This is the crap they're spewing out for the future. Multi-culti America. This stuff is going to make profits in the future, which is interesting. That's what Lucille Ball said about Star Trek. You know how Star Trek got made? The Paramount Pictures bought Desilu, and that meant that Lucille Ball. You know Lucy. I love Lucy. Lucy was now on the board of directors of Paramount. And she was a very, she liked to keep her nose in things, so she would attend meetings all the time and so on. She was a real pain in the neck. And Gene Roddenberry was pitching Star Trek finally to Paramount after everyone else had turned him down, and nobody wanted to make an expensive sci-fi thing because sci-fi was just for kids and so on. And in the back of the room, this whiskey cigarette-y voice said, "This will make millions in syndication." Because Lucille Ball knew that syndication was where you made money, as in I Love Lucy, which I think is still seen in syndication. And that's how Star Trek got made. So these people, they know what they're doing. So they're making movies that the
Yeah, it's either the
the brown
monetary
American.
policy angle or they're hedging, making a hedge on future change.
They're making movies for the future brown people who will watch anything. As long as there are lots of explosions and things, they're happy.
We're at the end of the show. James
Ooh.
O'Mara, thank you so much for being on. Check out his book, Mysticism After Modernism.
You would be well advised to do that, and I think you will
Where's
enjoy
the best place to find it?
it.
Amazon or directly
Well,
with Manicware
it is
Press?
on Amazon. Go to Countercurrents and countercurrents.com, and on the side there you'll see an array of books, and they do sell it through there. And it'll also have it'll show you the website for Amazon, for Barnes and Noble, and for Manticore Press. You can get it anywhere you want. I'm sure our friends in Australia will want to get it from Australia, from Manticore.